Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What makes a city resilient? What gives a city the ability to regroup and come back from disaster stronger than before? Those are the questions Tom Campanella has attempted to answer in his book, The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster, and he's our guest today on Smart City. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment takes a look at our planet's resilience from an environmental perspective. Its director, Walter Reed, is with us to talk about the science behind the opportunities and challenges of ecosystem change. We'll talk about resilient cities and environments after this news. Tom Campanella is co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. He is assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His work is focused on the history and design of the urban built environment, and he has particular interest in the historical development of the American urban landscape, the design and planning of new towns, and the rapid modernization of China's cities in the post-Mao era. He's a faculty fellow of the Institute for the Arts and Humanities at UNC. Tom, thanks for being our guest on Smart City. Tell me, what makes a city resilient?
There's a number of complex issues that come into play when you're dealing with urban resilience and recovery. Some of them deal with simple, pragmatic things like the insurance industry, the embedded infrastructure that a city will have. And also, you have this notion of connectedness that people have to a particular place, and that's something we explored in greater depth.
Could you discern the factors that distinguish those cities that come back from those that don't?
First of all, we have very few examples in modern times of cities that have not come back from even horrific disasters. One thing that we found is that in ancient times, in antiquity, there are a number of cities that have essentially been completely lost around the world. Monte Alban in what's today the Oaxacan area of Mexico. Timgad in Algeria, Pompeii is a well-known example. These cities were pretty much completely lost. But even in antiquity, it's not a common thing to have a city completely wiped away. Carthage, it's often used as an example of a city that was completely destroyed. In fact, it was destroyed repeatedly. The most devastating round of destruction took place right after the end of the Third Punic Wars, when the Romans leveled the city, and legend has it that they salted the earth to prevent crops being raised again in the area. But in fact, the Romans themselves later rebuilt the city about 100 years, 120 years later during the reign of Augustus, because the city made sense. It was an important port city for the Carthaginians, but then it actually became an important port city for the Romans too later on, and they used it as the administrative hub of their African possessions. Just to follow up on that, in the modern age, like after about 1811, we really have almost no examples of a major city being completely lost.
Tom, you talk about Carthage and you say the city was rebuilt because the city made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the location factors then were much greater than the location factors today. Certainly ports still matter. Transportation convenience still matters. But as you know, the ability of a city to attract and retain talented people is becoming far more important than it has ever been before. And so cities make sense less because of their location or the natural minerals or resources that they have proximity to, then again, their ability to attract talent. So in the case of a New Orleans, certainly, again, a port city, very important. But then there's this whole question of the ability to attract talent there again. How are the factors changing in terms of how a city makes sense and its not just ability, but the sense it makes, I guess,
right,
to revive?
Well, you know, New Orleans is a very interesting case here because, you know, one of the things that makes some cities so valued is that they have unique attributes of place. That there is something in the air. There's the cultural and social fabric of the place that really cannot be found anywhere else. And this is one of the reasons why San Francisco, for example, has been able to attract a very dedicated population that would rather live nowhere else. And in a certain sense, this also applies to New Orleans. This is a city that has, as you well know, a very distinct sense of place, a very powerful spirit, and a very unique culture. And so to talk in marketing terms, it got a very well-defined competitive edge culturally over other places.
Urban planner Alex Garvin says that cities consumed by keeping things the same are already dying. In a case like New Orleans, what do you think should be the mix of preservation and rethinking the city anew?
Clearly, you know, the icons of New Orleans need to be preserved. And I have no doubt that the iconic architectural and urbanistic qualities of New Orleans will not only make it through this, but bounce back stronger than ever. The touristic New Orleans is going to come back strong. There are other aspects of the city, the city's culture and built environment, that I think we're going to have to keep an eye on, because the logic of power and money is not going to be so much, you know, behind the revitalization of these other places. And I'm referring, of course, to some of these lower income communities that were really hard hit by the flooding in the wake of the storm.
I saw some statistics from the Initiative for a Competitive Inner City last week that said that 85% of New Orleanians in low-income areas worked, and they had 1.3 jobs on average. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've wondered how you rebuild a New Orleans, and particularly a New Orleans tourist industry, without those people coming back.
They've got to come back in some way. It's both for sustaining the tourism industry and the entertainment industry and the hospitality industry, but also for the vitality of the city as a whole. I mean, if the French Quarter and the Garden District and the New Orleans of Mardi Gras and Fat Tuesday and all that, if that comes surging back and attention isn't paid bringing back these other communities, these other parts of the city, the low-income communities, these vast neighborhoods that were so badly hit by this catastrophe, then it's not going to be a real city anymore. It's going to be a kind of, this idea that it'll be a theme park of sorts is not out of the realm of possibility, you know. And obviously, even if you have this focus on the touristic side of New Orleans, like you said, who's going to cook and clean and feed all these folks? Those workers have to live somewhere, and preferably within the city limits and not out somewhere in an outlying suburb where they're forced to commute in at great cost.
As an urban planner, does it bother you that perhaps the industry on which New Orleans is built, in fact, depends on the presence of poor people?
When it's stated like that, yes, it is somewhat exploitative. But on the other hand, many of these jobs are good jobs. And in a place that's been battered by economic woes, to lose those jobs on top of everything else would be a double catastrophe.
San Francisco reimagined its waterfront after the 1989 earthquake and removed a major road. Do you know much about the process, Tom, that led to what was a major change in that city?
Specifically, I don't. Obviously, a major disaster like this does offer opportunities to solve some long-standing infrastructure problems. One thing we found, though, that's a little counterintuitive is that the immediate wake of a disaster like this is actually not a very good time for dreamers and visionaries. The really radical, really innovative plans that seek to take the disaster as an opportunity to really set things right tend to be set aside. In a way, they're a luxury of good times to contemplate these possible futures. And what we see often in the immediate wake of a disaster is really a yearning to get back to the way things were yesterday. So radical innovation is really set aside. Now, in the longer run, you often see a range of innovations come forward and are often implemented. A good example of this is Chicago. After the Great Fire there in 1871, you know, it's well known that the city that replaced the burned city eventually was this city of masonry buildings, fire-resistant buildings, and even it was the birthplace of the skyscraper. But in fact, the first city that was rebuilt was nothing like this. It was really the same old shoddy fire traps that had burned and caused such a catastrophe. They were essentially rebuilt immediately after the fire, and it was only later that these architectural innovations came along.
I ask about the process in San Francisco because the process for rebuilding New Orleans looms, and the process for rebuilding downtown Manhattan, if that's any clue as to what it will be like has been very difficult, very frustrating. Is that typical?
Yes. One thing we've noticed in these different cases that we've studied was that you have a wide range of voices competing for attention in the wake of a disaster like this. And obviously, the voices that tend to win out are those of the dominant groups in the society, but they're often not unanimous on a vision of the future. So yeah, it's very common to have contesting visions for change to take place.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tom Campanella. He is co-editor with Lawrence Vail of The Resilient City. Tom, you're speaking about the speed of rebuilding, and people have a desire to get back to the way it was yesterday. So rebuilding often happens in an expedient way, I suppose, in terms of at least the plan and what is imagined or not imagined. There surely are some downsides of speed.
The psychological need that people have to gain what they lost is so powerful, it tends to really ride roughshod over the very time-consuming process of working through the details of a new plan or a new vision for a place. And, you know, this notion of resilience, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's progressive. You could almost think of a kind of regressive resilience as well when it comes to cities, meaning that in the rush to get back to the day before, many of the inequalities and disparities in power sharing and disparities in socioeconomic terms get reestablished as well.
I want to come back to this notion of connectedness. You said that's one of the things that underlies a city's ability to be resilient. What underlies connectedness? What leads to connectedness in resilient cities?
Cities obviously are a lot more than just the sum of their buildings. The cities are people, and it's the underlying networks of social connection, the social fabric, the connection people have to their religious institutions, their community institutions, the local political institutions. These things are enormously complex and really, really root a community, a people to a particular place. Now, the terrible thing about Katrina is that it really ripped this fabric apart as much as it did the physical fabric of the city. And now, you know, we have folks who have lived in New Orleans for generations, literally scattered to the four winds. And with every passing day, many more of these folks are not going to come back. You know, they're setting up home elsewhere. They're getting jobs in Houston and St. Louis and New York and elsewhere. And this is really, you can almost hear the social fabric tearing. If we don't get these people back, that will be a serious loss for the city.
But it will be a gain for other cities. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, it will be a gain, I guess, for other cities, but it's hard not to, at least for me, not to primarily think of it as the social capital of New Orleans bleeding away from that city.
Can you draw any general lessons about government's role in the comeback of devastated cities?
Well, the role of the government is obviously a huge and profound issue. One thing is that disaster tends to really expose the power structure, exposes the fault lines and fractures in a society, and can really make people demand a new level of accountability from their government, especially if there's a perception that the government didn't respond in the right way or fast enough or something along those lines. And so there's a real need for the government to quickly reestablish its legitimacy and authority.
Is New Orleans forever changed, or in 10 years this all be a footnote?
No, definitely not. Yes, the city is changed forever. While history shows us that no major city in modern times, at least, has been permanently lost, there's no question that a catastrophe of this magnitude profoundly alters the future of a place. Physically, socially, economically, politically, in every dimension, this is about as big as it gets. But there, of course, will be New Orleans. I have no question that the city is going to come back. The real question, then, is whose New Orleans comes back, and what does it look like, and who is it really for? And that's what really we need to keep an eye on and what we really need to focus on in terms of the reconstruction and the recovery. Its true resilience will lie also in bringing back, as I said before, the social networks, the social capital of the place.
If a city wanted to set about deliberately developing the quality of resilience, could it do so?
I think part of it would be making sure that the political system has a transparency to it. I think that it would involve solving socioeconomic problems here and now before something catastrophic occurs. You know, obviously, you know, so many of the problems we're seeing in the wake of Katrina in New Orleans were pre-existing conditions. And so, you know, if basic issues of equity and social justice and economic opportunity, education, but if these are in good order, then in the face of a traumatic event, a city will be much better able to bounce back.
Tom, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Great to be here.
Dr. Tom Campanella is co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. You're listening to Smart City. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about taking on the transit critics. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Walter Reed about his work as director of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, we think of Seattle as a progressive city, and yet Seattle is way behind when it comes to public transit. What's wrong in Seattle?
Well, there are cities that are sort of pursuing what I call the Moby Dick syndrome. That is, they've got some obsession that they can't quite get over. And in Seattle, it is transit. It's not that people there don't want transit. It's just that they keep fiddling with it. They did miss the train, so to speak, back in the 70s when they had an opportunity to get funding for a transit system. And they missed it then because everything out on that coast has to be put to a vote. And for whatever reason, the voters in the 70s weren't buying it. But since then, they have bought it. They've actually voted to create a light rail system called Sound Transit. And it seemed like they finally had sort of gotten behind the notion of rail transit. The problem is that Sound Transit, as a new agency, ran into some problems. It started having some cost overruns. Its revenue projections were a little bit too optimistic. So there was a big blow up over how could Sound Transit have misjudged this. So, you know, these things happen in public life as they do in private, and sometimes you just need to change the management out, get some new folks in there. And there's a kind of learning curve. But in Seattle, they weren't content to just see things through with Sound Transit. So while they're waiting for Sound Transit to get its act together, lo and behold, they approve yet another transit system, and this one is based on the notion of a monorail. Now, they already have a little sort of touristy monorail in Seattle. So they wanted to create one that goes for 14 miles. Now, this may seem a little crazy to you. It seems a little crazy to me. But in Seattle, they get carried away with these things because they love to debate transit. And guess what? They found out that the monorail authority that they've created has done exactly what Sound Transit has done, overestimated revenues, underestimated costs. So now there's a big blow-up about that. And they're trying to decide whether it makes sense to have two transit systems that are working at the same time, trying to do basically the same thing. Or maybe logic would prevail and they just decide which one really does work the best and stick with it. But in the meantime, they're still pursuing Moby Dick, the ultimate perfect transit system in Seattle.
You know, I hope they can figure this out because Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels has showed so much leadership in getting mayors around the country together to support the Kyoto principles. When the federal government failed to act, he decided that mayors could act, and he and his staff were really in the forefront there. So they're clearly advocates of sustainable strategies, and certainly transit has to be part of that picture. So I hope they get their act together on this one.
Yeah, if they could just get people on one train and decide which train it is they really like, it'll work a lot better.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith heads the Innovation in American Government program at Harvard, and he tells us about the tricky challenge elected officials face when weather threatens.
Generally, in our innovations program at Harvard, we try to shine a bright light at successful government innovations because so many things that are in the newspaper and on TV show what doesn't work in government. So What does work? And what does work particularly when a local or state official is faced with imminent challenges of a significant disaster? We're talking about what have communities done where they have successfully warned their citizens and allowed them to avoid much of the harm of these storms. It's a difficult thing. Today, many mayors and governors, county executives, actually have direct access to weather forecasting. So they have information, but how good is the information? And how much risk do you want to take? Because when to tell your citizens to evacuate or to take other precautions is critically important. And if you tell them too early and the storm changes course, that creates its own set of unfortunate circumstances. If you tell them too late, either they get caught out on the highways in gridlock, or worse yet, they don't leave at all. So how do you get the information? What's the decision-making process? And then how do you tell your citizens? Many mayors and governors, and maybe before Katrina others, thought they were comfortable relying on the media to get out the word. But a couple of problems with that. A, the media may not be right, and we saw some of that in this circumstance this month. And the other may be that not everybody, particularly those who live in extreme poverty, are quite as alert to these media signals. So what are the mechanisms? And I think more and more governments are saying, look, this has to be our primary responsibility, right? We have to have the responsibility, and we have to have the process of telling our citizens when they need to take precautions and when they need to evacuate. The programs we're highlighting today are some of the best, the award winners like OK First in Oklahoma City, where they have got the message right, they've got the way to communicate it right, and in so doing, they've avoided a lot of harm to their citizens.
We're all wondering whether our communities are prepared now for a major disaster. OK First was tested 6 years ago when 70 tornadoes hit the state in 1 month. What happened?
On May 3rd, 1999, we had a tremendous tornado outbreak in central Oklahoma, and the tornadoes that occurred ranged from F3 through F5 strength, which is the strongest on the scale of tornadoes. And on that night, we had several local communities that were completely destroyed by tornadoes. Some of the communities were part of major metropolitan areas. Other communities were very rural in nature. But in 1999, the emergency management community had at its disposal a decision support system called OK First. And this decision support system allowed emergency managers to access real-time weather information, as well as had prior training on how to use that information. So they'd already been through some of these disaster simulations on tornadoes like this so that they could make local decisions in conjunction with the National Weather Service as well as the local broadcast media. The impetus for Oklahoma being prepared to handle disasters such as tornadoes actually began back in 1984 when the city of Tulsa had a flash flood. And it turned out on that particular night, the National Weather Service did just an incredibly wonderful job with their flood warnings. But the ability to get the flood warnings to the people who needed them was a piece that was lacking. So the emergency management community really didn't have a viable way to access the warnings to make the local evacuation decisions necessary to save lives. And on that particular night, lives were lost. So we already had a disaster that took place in Oklahoma that we had to learn from, unfortunately, whereby we then began putting into place the necessary infrastructure, both in terms of weather sensing, the ability to get radar information into the hands of the emergency managers, as well as the necessary training. And this training is a huge part of it, because when Weather Service meteorologists and emergency managers who are not trained meteorologists have conversations on what is the best course of action for evacuations and what the risks are, it's incredibly important that they are on the same page with respect to the terminology. So the training portion was really, really key in this regard to allow our emergency managers to know how to ask questions, as well as when the Weather Service meteorologist responded, what to do in those cases. The way in which citizens can evaluate whether their community is prepared is to probably begin with their local emergency management agencies. And the local emergency management agencies, in particular in Oklahoma, have a long history of working together with the National Weather Service. So the disconnect between the word going out and local action being taken is not as prominent in Oklahoma because of our experiences as it might be in some other states. When you're looking at Gulf coastal states, of course, the hurricane risk is going to be at the focus. When you're looking at places like Oklahoma and Kansas and Nebraska, of course, the tornadic activity is going to be the focus. So it's incredibly vital that the emergency management community have in place working relationships not only with the Weather Service, but with the local infrastructure, the local individuals that will be carrying out the decisions so that everybody is on the same page. You do not want to go through the discussion and brainstorm process while the event is happening. You want to have had some opportunity to get that all out of the way ahead of time. The way in which you know that is in place in your community is at least typically now through a National Weather Service program called Storm Ready. The National Weather Service has a Storm Ready program where they have an application process whereby emergency managers can apply, and the application process is significant in that you have to show that you can get information through a variety of ways. You have to show that you have put in some disaster evacuation plans and things of that sort. If your community is not storm ready, then they have probably not gone through the formal process of working with the National Weather Service. So if you call up your local leaders and ask if your community is storm ready from the National Weather Service, if that answer is no, then it in all likelihood the community has not gone through the necessary steps to respond to disasters of this type.
Kevin, thanks for being our guest. Kevin Claisel is Outreach Director of OK First. You're listening to Smart City. Walter Reed directed the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, an international program launched by UN Secretary Kofi Annan in June 2001 and completed earlier this year. The Millennium Assessment synthesizes information from scientific literature, models, and data sets, and represents the work of more than 1,300 authors from 95 countries. Walt, if you had to write the headline that would grab America's attention about the findings of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, what would it be?
It would be that humans are depleting Earth's natural capital, and while we're obtaining short-term benefits from that, the costs are growing, just in the way that if we deplete our bank account, we obtain short-term benefits, but the costs grow, and eventually we need to figure out some way to replenish that account.
But the report got few headlines in the U.S. Why?
Internationally, it actually got quite a bit of coverage. In Europe, for example, it was the front page of the Le Monde, the French paper. It was front page in the U.K. and both of the Dutch leading dailies. It was on the broadcast news on two stations in London, and CNN International covered it. But here in the United States, it received extremely little coverage. And I think there's a number of factors involved there. First, it was called for by the United Nations and released by the UN. And here in the United States, there's, you know, frankly, I think things that come from the UN get less attention, whereas in Europe and other countries, of course, it gets more attention. In addition, though, here in the United States, the actual coverage by the media of environmental issues has gone down. Relatively few leading papers now even have environmental reporters, whereas 10 years ago, most would have had environmental reporters. And to some extent, I think here in the United States, the public still believes that there really aren't any limits, that technology and the wisdom, knowledge can sort of get us out of any fix. And this report, frankly, it's not a doom and gloom story because it shows very positive opportunities. It even still, it does show some worrisome trends. And I think here in the United States, people react to that by thinking, well, we'll fix it when we come to the serious problem. Whereas in Europe, I think they're much more aware of limits and more ready to understand that we need to take action early.
It's like we'll fix the levees and the wetlands.
Well, I think that
someday.
Experience was an eye-opener for everyone. And it certainly relates to, I think, how we would like to see people react to the findings of the Millennium Assessment. Because essentially what it's telling us is that if we can be proactive about problems, whether, frankly, it's hurricane risks in New Orleans or degradation of natural ecosystems, if we can be proactive, the actual net cost to society can be dramatically reduced. We shouldn't always be in the mode of reacting to catastrophes. We need to plan ahead and try to address these problems early.
Tell me about the assessment process itself.
As you know, this assessment was the largest scientific assessment ever made of the health of the planet. And by largest, we mean simply that it had the most scientists involved. It was a massive number, nearly 1,400 scientists from 95 countries. We would meet together in working groups over the course of about 3.5 years in cities all around the world to bring these scientists together to both draft and write papers. But much of it, of course, is an interactive process among the scientists to try to determine what are the issues that the scientific community is extremely confident about, where are there still areas of uncertainty, and where are there big remaining questions that we really need to answer in order to provide guidance to policymakers. And then overlaid on that was an extensive process of interaction with the decision makers, because this wasn't intended to be just a scientific report. It was really intended to provide advice and guidance to policymakers. And so there were extensive interactions with governments, with the private sector, with NGOs, even with indigenous groups around the world. So it was a very elaborate process, but then in the end, and it produces a massive amount of material, nearly 2,500 pages of the full assessment reports. But in the end, you distill it down into smaller and smaller synthesis reports, and the very final product that we produced was really just about an 18-page synthesis of the core findings.
And what were the core findings?
Well, four basic findings. The first was that the pace and scale of changes that humans have made to ecosystems over the last 50 years is greater than at any comparable period of time in human history. So just the rate of change to the planet's ecosystems is now skyrocketing. The second is that while we have certainly benefited substantially from that, and one need look no further than just at agriculture and how much the expansion of agriculture has benefited people, while we've benefited, the costs associated with this are growing, and we see that growth in three areas. First, we're actually now degrading most of what we refer to as ecosystem services. These are the benefits that we get from ecosystems. It includes food production and water supply, but it includes things like protection from storms, protection from floods, the regulation of climate, pollination, cultural benefits, aesthetic benefits we get from the environment. And we found that nearly 60%, or 15 out of 24, of these ecosystem services that we looked at are now being degraded, and often with very substantial costs for people. We also found that the risks of very abrupt changes are going up, and that the impact of these changes on the poorest people are the greatest. The poor suffer the most from these changes. So that was the second major conclusion, just that these costs are growing. The third conclusion is that the current trends, if we don't change them, the problems will actually get worse in the next 50 years and already present a very major barrier to achieving the world's development goals to alleviate poverty and increase human health. Then the fourth conclusion is actually the slightly more positive side. We did a set of scenarios to look at how the world might evolve in the coming 50 years. And we found that in several of these scenarios, it was actually possible to turn around the degradation of many of the services. It takes very significant changes in policies, very significant new technologies, but one can actually solve much of this problem in a fairly short period of time.
Well, your fourth conclusion is on the one hand hopeful, but do you think it also runs the risk of just putting the decisions off that policymakers need to make? You know, the notion of, we can solve this, you know, I'll deal with that tomorrow at Tara.
To be honest, I actually think it may have the other effect, because I think one of the problems of many of the, I don't know how to phrase it, sort of traditional environmental analyses that have looked at what humans are doing to the planet is, frankly, they are so bleak that it almost makes you want to just give up hope. You look at some of the older reports that show the changes and show the loss of biological diversity, and you just end up thinking, well, there's nothing that can be done here. Where we find ourselves today is that we now know about many different ways in which we can address many of these problems. We also benefit from the fact that as you look out 50 years, we see that the actual growth of human population finally is likely to plateau. The estimates are that we will see the peak of human population somewhere around 2060 or 2075. And so you won't have that continuing growth of human population, and add to that the opportunity to put in place new economic incentives, new policies to try to address these problems. You can actually see that you can come to grips with these problems.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Walter Reed. He is the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Panel Director. Walter, where do you think the most leverage lies in turning around and correcting the problems that your assessment found?
Well, there's really two areas that I would single out, but probably the largest of the two relates to getting the economic incentives right. What we find is that most of these ecosystem services that I described that are being degraded, the ones that are being degraded are the ones that are public goods, which means we benefit from them, but they're provided freely by nature, something like the role of wetlands in protecting from floods. The estimates are, for example, in the Mississippi River, that originally wetlands in the Mississippi River could basically absorb about 60 days worth of flow of the Mississippi River. But the changes we've made losing wetlands along there has now reduced that to just 12 days. Now, that was a free benefit that those ecosystems provided. There was nobody that made money from that benefit, and so, not surprisingly, they were lost. So what we need to do is establish economic incentives to make it in the interest of people to actually continue to allow ecosystems to provide these services. And I'll give you two examples of where that can be done, or has been done, actually. In Costa Rica, for example, they are convinced that the loss of forest in that country is a major, not only environmental problem, but a major economic problem, because they rely on the forest cover for both tourism and also to protect their watersheds for energy production. So what they've done is they've put a small tax on energy use, and then they take the funds raised from that to basically pay farmers to grow trees instead of converting land to agriculture, and they call it payment for ecosystem services. And once you have that positive incentive, of course, the farmers then do grow trees, and you end up getting the public good met because the forest isn't lost. Here in the United States, we have a somewhat analogous program we call the Conservation Reserve Program, where farmers in the Midwest, for example, they can pull some of their cropland out of production and put it in conservation reserves, and they still get paid a subsidy for that. One of the things that we see as a real opportunity in the United States is to expand that Conservation Reserve Program to provide more of this economic incentive for better management of ecosystems. So that general area of economic incentives, often it's possible to create markets to protect these services, is a high priority. The other one does relate to technology. In order to meet the needs of what will eventually be probably 9 billion people on the planet with a well over $100 trillion economy, that human presence has a very substantial demand on ecosystem services. And in many cases, we do now well exceed the capacity of ecosystems to meet this demand. We see that in water, marine fisheries, both of those are areas that are being unsustainably used. And so clearly we need technologies that would allow us to use these ecosystem services much more efficiently, so there's much less waste, so that we don't put as much pressure on the service, and in many cases so that we can develop alternatives to those services. So I think the economic incentives and new technologies are really the core to the solution here.
Are the technologies that you're referring to everywhere? Are they spread out in universities, or is there any concentration of research that you think is particularly promising?
It is quite spread out. I often like to compare this problem of ecosystem change with the problem of climate change. Climate change, as you know, is one of the drivers of changes to our planet's ecosystem. So in a way, it's a subset of it. But in the case of climate change, it seems so incredibly difficult to grapple with, and yet it's relatively easy compared to ecosystems, because the basic problem is we're putting too much carbon into the atmosphere, and you can look at the energy use flows and figure out where carbon is being used, whether it's automobile fuels or electric generation, and then try to figure out ways to develop new technologies and new alternatives. But when you look at this broader array of factors that are causing ecosystems to change, you're basically looking at every single sector of human existence. It includes all of the climate change problems. It includes all of agricultural issues, fishing issues, water issues. And in each of those areas, there are significant new technology opportunities, but they're really not in any sense clustered by sector. They're not clustered in any particular region. This actually, it relates quite closely. In order to get these technologies, it does relate to the point about economic incentives. Since we can't identify a single new silver bullet technology, what we need to do is across the board provide incentives so that people, companies, universities working on new technologies have an incentive to develop these alternatives. And that will relate in part to what economists would say is getting the prices right, making sure that people are paying the full cost for their use of services and paying a fee if they are actually damaging service ecosystem services through their actions.
I was listening to a conversation with Bill Clinton recently, and he singled out the CEO of GE as the most hopeful sign in America that we're going to take this issue seriously. Tell me, were you able to capture the attention of business with this report?
We were quite successfully, and the example you gave of GE is, let me sort of spend a moment on that, and it will explain, I think, why we were so successful in getting business involved. The GE example, GE basically is committed to investing, I believe it's something like $1 billion in new research for cleaner technologies related to energy production. And they've set targets for greenhouse gas emission reductions within GE. And if you look at the business sector on that issue of climate change, historically, first they were very opposed to doing anything. Then they agreed to at least starting to measure their own greenhouse gas emissions. Then they started taking on targets to control them. And now what you see in an announcement like that is that companies actually now see market opportunity in developing new technologies to solve the problem. And that's a wonderful sign of progress. For many of these other ecosystem issues, we're actually sort of at that very first stage. We're trying to sort of get that initial recognition in the private sector that a problem exists. But I think because they've gone through this experience with the climate issue, they see that the leading companies aren't going to be the ones that just fight the inevitable. They will be the ones that become what's referred to as the first movers, the companies that charge out in front, see the opportunities, make changes in their own policies, but also see where there's new economic and business opportunities to develop new technologies or to change their investment patterns. And so what we found is that when we would approach companies, for example, to be on the board of this assessment or to be involved in a synthesis report that we made for business, there was a tremendous receptivity to that. So it's quite encouraging, although frankly, there's an awful lot that needs to be done. So we need more support from business sector by all means.
Which countries are doing the best job protecting the ecosystem and responding to this report, this assessment?
I think in terms of the countries that are out in front on this, one that I mentioned already, Costa Rica, really stands out. Probably about 15 to 20 years ago, they recognized that the economic future of that country was linked to having sustainably managed ecosystems. And across the board, they have set policies with that goal in mind, and it is very much paying off right now. They'd be the first to admit they still have major challenges. They have a lot to do, but that country stands out. The countries that have perhaps paid most attention to trying to protect a broad array of ecosystem services are probably New Zealand, Australia, and interestingly, even China, because of their efforts to make sure that they don't lose forest cover that's necessary to prevent flooding in downstream areas. So China has been fairly proactive on this. Looking at countries that are most responsive to the report itself, I think it's actually probably the Scandinavian countries and many of the least developed countries. And that's because so many of the recommendations that come out of this report focus on the importance of environmental conservation ecosystem protection in the least developed countries in order to meet the needs of the poorest people. You see many of those countries focusing on trying to implement the findings, and you see many of the Scandinavian countries, which are very, very supportive of international development efforts, also focusing on the findings. So I think
Technology Review did an interesting map of the world several months ago and looked at the technology breakthroughs that were being focused in various countries around the world. While the U.S. was a leader in defense technologies, it was interesting, China was a leader in conservation technologies, which really surprised me. But I guess they realized that as they industrialize, they already have environmental problems. And to put that many new cars and that many new appliances in China, they have not only an obligation to do it differently, but I suppose there's also real gain from an economic standpoint if they can invent those new technologies and then sell them to the world.
I think that's right. I think you see in China the phenomenon that's been referred to as leapfrogging happening in real time, because China faces massive environmental problems. They have major pollution problems, water pollution related to the small industries that they have, still extensive problems of deforestation, groundwater depletion, desertification. And yet they recognize those problems exist. And rather than just sort of trying to cope with them, what they're trying to do is leapfrog and develop technological solutions that can both address the problems, but also potentially become business opportunities. I note, for example, that China now has higher auto fuel efficiency standards than the United States. And it's undoubtedly in part to protect their own environment and their own demands for oil to keep those down. But it's also so they can develop an auto industry that is then internationally competitive so that they can start selling cars to other countries. And I think it's very wise policies that you see trying to correct for some massive environmental problems. So they have a ways to go to actually fix those problems, but they're going at it very constructively.
And how is the U.S. doing?
The U.S., it's a bit of a mix. I think if you look at the state level in the United States, and particularly within non-governmental organizations as well, you see a vast array of innovation on these issues of ecosystem management. The United States, for example, has various programs for protection of biological diversity, various innovative market instruments like wetlands banks, where if a company needs to convert some area out of wetland, they have an opportunity to invest money elsewhere to protect more wetland in other locations. So you see a number of very innovative actions, and some states like the state of California and several others have invested very extensively in ecosystem protection for watersheds and so forth. At the same time, I guess you can't help but say for the country as a whole that there's some glaring problems. We still, for example, have not come to grips with our marine fisheries management in this country. We still are depleting many fisheries, U.S. fisheries and coastal waters, and our international role as well, that we know is a problem. We know how to solve it, but we haven't taken the action. Even some areas where I think most Americans would say we've made substantial progress, like clean water, we still have, I believe it's more than 50% of the rivers in the United States, rivers and lakes, do not meet clean water standards of being fishable, swimmable rivers. And you see, of course, the massive problem of climate change and the U.S. role in greenhouse gas emissions, where the United States has not even stepped up to the now sort of widely shared international standards that have been accepted under the Framework Convention for Climate Change. So it's frankly very much a mixed picture. I think in a way what disappoints me the most is that if the U.S. were very proactive on these issues, it would be a model for many, many other countries, and it would not only help our own country address these issues, but it would basically catalyze action by hundreds of other countries as well.
Walt, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
It's been my pleasure.
Walter Reed is professor at the Institute for the Environment at Stanford University and panel director of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says even though the pictures were disturbing, goodness prevailed in New Orleans.
The TV images were stark and disturbing. Tens of thousands torn from their neighborhoods and homes, bereft of everything they owned and washed up around the edges of shelters, reeling from the staggering numbers displaced by Hurricane Katrina. Day after day, the agony persisted, unabated and unrelieved, horrifying the world with the awful scenes being played out on cable TV. New Orleans appeared to be sinking into chaos and disarray right before our eyes. And as reports about gangs of thugs running wild began to pour in, we became even more outraged by the absence of an effective response to the mayhem unfolding before us. It seemed to confirm our darkest fears about human nature. Yet something else was happening too, something more widespread and far more important. Mesmerized by scenes of the massive destruction, we missed or just ignored the most amazing and uplifting sight of all. Even as breathless headlines of collapse kept pouring in, the overwhelming majority of the desperate, displaced people of New Orleans did not sink to bloody tooth and claw. Instead, they waited peacefully and as orderly as they could for help and relief. They did not turn against one another in a Hobbesian nightmare of quote-unquote war of all against all. Only the thugs were intent upon that, and headlines notwithstanding, they were no more than a few in number. Mostly what we saw was an unwashed flowering of the best in people, not the worst. Dozens, if not hundreds of people took to the waters in canoes and john boats to rescue others. Doctors and nurses at every hospital stayed with their patients, swallowing their own worries about home and family while they struggled to get people safely evacuated. Police and security guards also put their personal priorities aside as they stayed at their post in neighborhoods, hotels, and businesses. Certainly some officers were overwhelmed by the stress and devastation, and we heard about them throwing in the towel. But this was only evidence of their basic humanity. Like everyone, they struggled to find a way to cope in a decent and caring way. And if the circumstances left them unable to do that on the job, then the honest thing to do was, in fact, to move on. People's unshakable goodness was particularly evident at the Superdome and the Convention Center. Both situations were gruesome and macabre. Food, water, and patients were in urgently short supply. Yet decency was everywhere to be seen. The dead were covered and mourned. People shared their food and water with others in greater need. They did their best to look after those suffering the most. They didn't steal or fight. They sat and waited in the heat and humidity for help to arrive. Not even all of the looting was for pillage. Often it was for nothing more than sheer survival in the face of little help. It has been a terrible time in the aftermath of Katrina. But let's keep our perspective on what we've seen. Community, not anarchy, did and will prevail. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.